This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by Lightspeed's Agile DC Executive Summit. Learn more at agiledcsummit.com.
We are the Agile Coaching Exchange Atlanta chapter, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Everyone, this is Jennifer Fix, and I'll be your host this evening. Our topic is Agile outside of IT and how we can use lean and agile methodologies in industries outside of technology. To help us dig in, I have the pleasure of speaking with Arlen Bankston.
Hello, Jennifer.
Hello, Arlen. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we dig in, I think we should probably introduce ourselves. So
Indeed.
If you want to go ahead and just tell everyone who you are and what you do.
Certainly. So the name is Arlen Bankston. I'm actually the owner of a company called Lightspeed. That's L-I-T-H-E, just for the record, Speed. And we're basically an agile consultancy out of the Washington, D.C. area, specifically in Herndon, Virginia. Briefly, my background was originally in user experience design and product management. I got into the Agile scene by essentially discussing how we could blend those methods with it, initially extreme programming. And since then, I've really explored all the methods. For today's podcast, I think it's relevant that a lot of the work I've been doing in the past few years has indeed been outside of the technology space, in various other business silos and also in just areas that aren't related to software at all.
Great. Thank you. And my background, I currently work for the Atlanta Speech School, a nonprofit program for them called the Rollins Center, where I help oversee their digital strategy and agile process. And my background is primarily as a scrum master, have some background in marketing, and have worked with a number of teams to help move them and transition them to agile and scrum practices. I've primarily worked in scrum, dabbled in Kanban, have a few different times worked to move marketing teams to Agile. So looking forward to getting to discuss more about how we help groups outside of IT think about Agile and how they can apply it.
Well, hopefully we can have a good discussion.
Yes. All right. So let's just start with a little bit about how you originally started thinking about bringing Agile outside of the IT field. What got you thinking about that and moving in that direction?
Honestly, it just happened because our clients largely approach us. I would say from my own perspective, though, I'll start from just the mindset. I've always viewed Agile as something outside of technology necessarily. A lot of the early examples I saw of its usage were, in fact, in non-software development contexts as such. And if you look at the origins of a lot of the methods, that is in lean manufacturing out of Toyota, you take things like, say, the daily scrum, largely influenced by MIT. Jeff Sutherland actually still lives out in Boston, and in fact, I was inspired by their demo or die approach, so to speak, and by their morning meetings just to sync with things. So a lot of the aspects of what became Scrum, what became Kanban, emerged from areas that never necessarily had anything to do with technology to begin with. So in that sense, it always made some sense to me. Lately, in the past few years, we've seen a lot of applications in various areas, and we'll go through the stories as we proceed through the podcast. But everything from seeing it in silos like marketing and operations and finance, which is a necessity, I think, for making an agile company, having that sort of across-the-board, holistic view of agility. And then looking also in other business domains, just in areas you wouldn't necessarily expect, like education or running your own household at home, that sort of thing.
Sure. So on that note, which non-technical fields do you feel like seem to be most interested in you in the movement? Most interested, in your opinion, in the movement towards Agile and Lean? Do any stick out to you that seem to be moving that direction?
Unquestionably, marketing is one that's received a lot of attention. Just out of curiosity, I'm actually in the process of doing a book, around marketing, but around the Agile Leader's Guide to HR and People Operations is what its title is. But out of curiosity, I jumped on Amazon and I said, how many books are there on Agile marketing versus Agile HR? There are dozens. Actually, around agile marketing right now, some of them seemingly fairly small scale, some larger, but that's an area that I've seen a lot of attention in. Several of my projects also have emerged from that area in particular. I think HR is another one that's maybe a little fresher in people's minds, but absolutely critical to this because of the actual function that human resources has in an organization, of hiring the right sort of people and making sure that performance management systems and that sort of thing align with Agile principles and reinforcing all of that organizationally. So those are a couple of the areas I see. In terms of areas of, that seem to be on the horizon soon, finance seems to be one that's coming quickly, right? In particular, a lot of the work my company's been doing of late has been in the federal government space. And one of the problems there since the get-go, really, has been the fact of the, how they finance and fund and do contracting and award, you know, programs in the first place. It tends to, you know, not be a very modular process. They tend to award things in massive chunks, which leads to lots of bidding games up front, and it just makes it hard to do Agile in general. Mm-hmm. So I think that the finance is really one of the next big areas, and you're hearing about, you know, continuous budgeting and more Agile methods of contracting and so on.
And, well, why don't we dig into marketing a little bit?
Okay.
Let's just get right to it. I'm curious to know, what problem have businesses been coming to you with when they say that they're interested in moving their marketing department, or if they are just a marketing firm? What are they coming to you and saying that they need to be able to do differently?
So quite often they want to be able to move more rapidly. And a lot of the marketing aspect of it, from what I've experienced, has been about feedback in many ways. Mm-hmm. That is, receiving more rapid indications of whether or not a given campaign strategy or a certain marketing tack is working, whether it's having an impact, whether this version or that version are more appropriate. And this actually also is closely tied to digital strategy, right? That is, marketing departments are definitely these days moving towards a much more digital means of operation. So marketeers therefore have to be, to some degree, software people themselves to be able to you know, work properly in the modern world of the various tools and so forth that are available. I think the other thing, and this doesn't apply just to marketing, but certainly is a big picture item there, is the idea of more poly-skilled individuals, of trying to, you know, get more cross-functional teams, essentially, much as you see in a standard Scrum implementation. So that, again, they can shorten the delivery loop and the feedback loop, so that end-to-end you have all the people you need that are working together day by day rather than working in long cycles independently and then passing things off from one group to the next.
And when you have a marketing team come to you, do they typically approach you as, we just know that we need to work a little bit more iteratively, or do you find that they're actually attaching the Agile term to it, and they know this is something that seems like it's gaining a lot of traction, and you know something about this, so maybe you can help us? What do you feel like they typically come in knowing or perceiving that they know about how they might want to try and change the way they work?
Well, since I run an Agile consultancy, they tend to come to me knowing they want to do Agile, at least. They know what the term means, but they don't know a lot about it.
Right.
Quite commonly, they haven't really experienced it, or a handful of the folks have, and the rest haven't. I think they're less about, though, in general, implementing, say, Scrum and just doing Scrum and seeing that as a good thing. And they really are more about the actual results that they're hoping to achieve. So in many cases here, they've been frustrated by long delivery cycles. They've been, one group I was working with recently deals in very large, if you will, exhibitions and concerts and things like that, for sort of loyalty rewards for elite members of a hotel group. And in that particular instance, they're noting they need to be more adaptive, which is, of mm-hmm. course, the essence of agility in the first place, because they're often faced with things like people canceling at the last minute, like the artists who are doing the concert, or the venues changing things up, or the caterers not arriving, and things like that. And so they find themselves under the gun to have to respond very rapidly in those situations. And they're saying, how could we do this in a bit less risky way,
mm-hmm.
right? And a bit more, making that part of it, systematically allowing ourselves to respond to those sorts of things.
One thing you made me think of this that has come up for me in working with marketing teams trying to be more agile is that they're confronted with the traditional structure of the external organizations they need to work with. So to the example of a marketing team that needs to work with trade shows, a trade show has to have certain information 6 to 8 months in advance, and they have to get these banner designs out by X amount of time, and that can feel like a constraint to the marketing team. How can I be agile and work in this iterative movement when I'm tied to external deadlines that are not my own?
Indeed.
I'd be curious, from your perspective, how have you tried to help alter their thinking on that or help reframe that so they can be agile internally and still meet those deadlines that they have with their partners?
I've always viewed agility as a process of working within some manner of constraints. Quite often, they're purposefully self-imposed constraints. So if we have a date that's very clear, that actually is to some degree a benefit, because it says there's definitely a point where we're going to be delivering, which really turns our question to, given the resources we have on hand, and quite often those aren't terribly variable either, what is the best value that we can actually elicit from this group of people by that date, right? And I think the trick of doing that sort of thing using traditional methods is, since you have kind of a serialized process of doing the planning, doing the delivery, doing testing, putting things out, writing about things, if any of those stages go wrong, it has a ripple effect throughout all the rest of them, which makes it a very risky proposition, right? You could hit the date with nothing or next to nothing. Whereas taking an agile approach to it, you may still look and have, the broad strokes of things relatively settled, and you're not necessarily adapting in terribly dramatic ways. But what you are doing is kind of looking back at your plan along the way and saying, is anything going a bit awry here? Or have we learned anything where we need to adapt? And if you do that with a cross-functional enough group and do it in small enough cycles, it can be easy enough to sort of tune things so that by the time you hit the date, in the worst case, there are no nasty surprises, right? At least if something's going to go wrong, you've had the team talk about it and come up with some manner of mitigation strategy in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Have you found in working with marketing teams in particular that there's a certain style of Agile that seems to resonate best, Scrum or Kanban or a combination?
I've quite often seen a combination of the two, some manner of a Scrum-Ban strategy.
Scrum-Ban, yeah.
Yeah. I'd say quite often they'll start with Scrum. When you begin to implement it, Kanban can be rather useful because of the small cycle nature of a lot of marketing sort of efforts, and the fact that one particular team may do a number of different types of work. Some of this, long form sort of work over multiple months. Some other things may be very rapid response sort of items. And in those cases, things like the idea of service classes in Kanban can come in handy for actually managing that flow of work and, dealing differently with the big picture stuff than the little tiny onesie-twosie stuff.
Do you feel that when you're working with the marketing team, so presumably some of these teams might not have as much experience with development cycles and they're used to working in more of a traditional marketing framework,
right,
as is fair given their industry, do you find that it's helpful to try and train them out the gate on in-depth training on Scrum or Kanban, or do you like to try and do a combination of starting them to walk them through it and giving them that more in-depth training along the way?
Quite often we'll do things that are I would say not terribly dissimilar to things like certified Scrum Master training, which we do. That is, relatively basic introduction of the methods, but absent some of the jargon. What I've been doing tuning over time is turning it a little away from just the basic agile terminology and turning it a little towards some more general ideas of the intent of what you're trying to extract. In particular, in the book that I mentioned, the Leader's Guide to Agile HR and People Operations, I came up with five principles in particular, and this is what I've been using of late in these sorts of workshops. The first of which is understand value. It's kind of the notion that we often don't really know what value means, and a lot of Agile methods seem to assume that you've got one person who has just a crystal clear notion of exactly what needs to be built at any point in time, which is dangerous, actually, to have that sort of thinking in most industries, because you quite often may have a good idea, but not a perfect one for sure. So that idea of understanding value and turning a lot of the energies of the team toward learning. There's focusing on feedback. That's a big part of the marketing when that comes up all the time, right? That is feedback both internally from a process angle, things like retrospectives in Scrum are an example of this, and feedback from a product angle, right? That is getting things out to actual customers, getting out of the building, talking to real people, right? Not keeping inside your own walls. Think big, build small was another one of them. That is, do big picture planning, but keep up with things on a daily basis, an hourly basis. The idea of working together, cross-functional teams, having multiple disciplines represented within a marketing discipline, let's say. And making work visible. That is, not have everything in a big spreadsheet or complicated plan, but having it, one simple collective means of a information radiator of some sort or a task board or something that people can see, interact with collectively. So a lot of those ideas, it keeps it away from a lot of the jargon and keeps people from feeling like this is about software all the time.
Right.
These are common sense notions in many ways, right? And it's easier to tie it in that way.
It's interesting, to your second point, the focus on feedback. In working with marketing teams, I found that they're almost relieved by having this short cycle after which they need to report on how things are going, because they're being called in the industry to do that with the tools that they're using, with social and Google Analytics and all of these tools where they have that immediate feedback on what's happening and they need to report to it. And having this natural iterative cycle where they have to go in and evaluate kind of gives them an avenue to do that as a part of their job and as a part of doing Scrum or Kanban well.
Indeed.
It's taking that time to reflect and measure and then move forward. And then they're able to do their jobs better.
You noted prior to this discussion, we were chatting a bit and you were noting that, you know, you've seen some, if you will, hesitation towards releasing less than perfect things in certain organizations that you've worked with. And of course, this is true across the board with creative entities, creative people. And as such, I think one thing I turn to is this idea of at Pixar, I've read that the animation departments come in and each morning, the head of the animation department asks the animators, show me what you're up to, right? Show me the cells you're working on or whatever. And the idea about this, while of course it's to some degree to offer feedback, I like that, I don't, it is much less that, and it's much more simply getting them comfortable with the idea of showing partially done work. Mm-hmm. Because again, you'll have people go dark, build things for weeks, and then of course, they're emotionally attached to it. It's hard for them to change it. It's depressing if they do. And also, they worked on it for so long, it's an expensive proposition from the business perspective for them to change it. So from the marketing perspective, I think this is a big idea that it used to be, you're gonna print some, you know, big four color, you know, separation sort of brochure or something. It's an expensive, long proposition. Mm-hmm. So you gotta get it right, right? And there's a big cost to getting it not perfect. Whereas these days, you can see people pop stuff out there all the time and every channel you can think of, and it surely isn't always 100% perfect and polished. So I think, you know, really this is an idea of, in marketing and in other disciplines, getting used to the idea that we can put out things that are, you know, not flawless and necessarily comprehensively complete, and people are more okay with that than they used to be, and we can learn more effectively that way often than we can by just talking about it in sort of a echo chamber internally all the time.
I think that's a really good segue into the importance of having that buy-in from the leadership or from your manager, whoever's asking you to show them your work in progress, creating a safe space for your team to do that. Because if you show them that work in progress and then you see it and you tell them it's horrible, they're not going to want to do that anymore. But being able to reinforce the value of like, this is great, can I share some thoughts with you or ask some questions, and just create that space where you can share openly. And I think it helps create a bigger environment and culture of that openness and a feedback loop.
I agree completely. And I think to take that even a step further, I think a big message to leadership, one which I like to enforce, is the notion that you really should not view agile methods as a delivery engine solely, right? Or even maybe not primarily. It's a learning engine, right? It's really a tool for you to go out there and figure out if your strategic ideas are on point or they're not, and at a minimum to strengthen them, right, by going and putting them against the fire of reality and throwing it out there and seeing what people actually do with things. So when leaders start thinking of that way of, oh, this isn't about I have to get everything perfect, give it to these people to build it, and then they're just going to do whatever I say. So I've got to make sure, you know, all my thoughts are polished and you know, and pristine at that point. If they think more, you know, I can throw something crazy over to these guys, and they have this process that allows them to test and learn and then go and actually, you know, build out my idea on my behalf while keeping me in the loop, well, that's easier, right? That makes my life more comfortable. That makes this job a heck of a lot more fun for me, for them, right? So it even things like, you know, on the technology side, even movements like DevOps in very large part are about shortening this cycle from strategy to execution and back, which has long been a theoretical nirvana, but very rarely a real thing in organizations.
I like that, theoretical nirvana.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I feel like we can apply that to almost any area of life, too.
Exactly.
I'm going to write that one down and use it again later. So thinking about marketing, we've talked about some of that.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that HR is the other area that you're seeing a lot of movement and action in that area.
Indeed.
Obviously, HR and marketing are pretty different, but are you finding consistent concerns or challenges, or does HR seem to be pretty separate to you in some of what they're struggling with and trying to accomplish?
I think a lot of it is similar, right? Mm-hmm. There are also feedback loops, but with HR, they're less, in general, external feedback loops, if you will. That is extra organizational feedback loops, and they're more internal feedback loops. That is where HR is there, of course, to support a company, you know, in operating more efficiently, having the, you know, retention being higher, things of that nature, having appropriate people to staff the gigs they've got and so on. So I think that the challenges are different there in terms of what they're actually trying to achieve. The way they actually go about it is very similar, mm-hmm. right? You still have the problem of, in HR, a lot of specialized functions, which quite often are not really talking to each other all that often, which means big old long projects. You know, just to get a bit tangible about this for a moment, one example, a company that was a client of ours for a number of years and we keep in close touch with is the Motley Fool, right, out in the D.C. area. And a very forward-thinking company. And their HR department, I think, is a pretty good example of how this would work. They, at one point, had, you know, if you will, a fairly traditional process of performance management. And that is, you know, people have annual reviews and, you know, they get raises every so often and so on. And they felt like it just didn't really vibe with their culture very well. So they ended up moving to a process where they do much, much shorter cycle reviews. They'll do things like move people from one role to another. At one point, they're... I believe it was their CIO became their CFO, right, as a, in a move just to keep some flexibility in the upper ranks and keep an appreciation for the other jobs. If you know that you're always going to be shifted into another role at any point in time, which may be entirely outside of your domain, you don't rest on your laurels, you don't, like, fight for one area and make it yours and, you know, try to protect it from intrusion by others, you know, you're going to be more flexible and you're going to have more of kind of a, you know, a cross-silo mentality, more of a value stream orientation personally, which makes the leadership much more effective. They spend a lot of energy on getting people onboarded. They have an interesting process. One of the stories I tell in my book is about this. When somebody joins, they have them come in a Friday morning and very rapidly, in about an hour or so, get all the paperwork out of the way. So, like, all the dreck, you know, that nobody has a lot of fun with. And they're like, okay, now... They give them a snack and beverage cart, and they say, yeah, go around and give everybody something to eat, right? And so they roll a cart around the company, and all these people have been informed that this new person's coming by. So they usually have, like, they'll give them a beverage, right? And then the person will put a little gift for the new employee in their beverage cart. So it creates this little interaction in a, you know, obviously an informal and sort of, you know, non-intimidating way, I guess. So by the end of the day, they met everybody in this sort of fashion. Then they give them a gift certificate for a $150 dinner out, you know, restaurant of their choice with their significant other. So they're trying to get, like, the family in on it. Now the family's happy you joined the Fool too, right? And that they're feeling good about it. And by Monday, you're there. You have a lot of flexibility in what job role you pick, where you sit. They've got things like all their desks are rolling desks where you have literally one plug to unplug and then you move it somewhere else. So the HR department support all these things, right? They talk to people and they ask them, who's somebody you admire? And one, for instance, Elon Musk was one of the guys that was admired by one of the folks at the company, shockingly. And lo and behold, they brought Elon Musk on site and had him do a little presentation, right? So they try to set you up with something that's really going to, you know, personally engage you. So it's kind of a neat example there.
I think we might all be applying to the Motley Fool now.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's a great place.
That sounds pretty amazing. Yeah. So one of the things that I think about with HR that seems interesting is so much of HR is around human interaction and these building these relationships with people. It's not always about building a product or releasing something new necessarily.
Of course.
And I'm curious how you feel you've been able to work with these teams to incorporate that into what they're doing, because feedback loops are a little more challenging when you can't turn to something you've built and say, look what I built, here it is, and we can talk about that process, but instead you're talking about tough conversations you had to have and helping get team members from point A to a more effective point B.
Yeah, there are, so I just sticking with the Fool example for a moment, one of the things that they found fundamental to changing the mindset of their HR department was when they looked at it initially, they said, where we seem to be focusing is on negative events, right? HR seems to be all about keeping our fat out of the fryer, more or less. Mm-hmm. And they said, that's a bit of a bummer, right? I mean, we really rather this be where HR is about, well, I mean, to put it simply, that means the HR people are spending all their energy on low performers, They said, this is stupid. We should just, you know, get rid of the low performers. And we should be spending most of our energy on, in fact, keeping the excellent performers. Because what you end up with otherwise is an HR department that puts in place a lot of onerous and, you know, recovering practices, so to speak, here, that instead of saying, here's how we can make this company more inspiring and, you know, a place that people really want to land at. So they turning that mindset, saying we're about making this an awesome place to work, not about, you know, that of course the legalities and all that are still covered, but that's a minor part of the affair, and it's not the main focus. So a lot of their feedback loops, a lot of HR is about testing the ideas they have, their new performance management system when they implemented it. They tested it using actually like paper prototyping and things of this nature, and weekly cycles with a lot of their internal employees, not all of them, but some of them. Right, and are they able to say, how do you like this process, for instance, doing a review with a manager to try to get feedback on performance? And they tested a few different ways, tuned it over time, and by the time they rolled it out to everyone, they tested with dozens of different people in the organization, and it was a fait accompli.
It's almost like the HR team becomes the culture champions for the organization.
Precisely, right? Rather than being seen as kind of the, you know, the culture cops or something
right,
of that nature,
right.
Which is often the feel you get. They're seen as the people who help you, right? Help to solve a lot of your problems and remove a lot of the organizational constraints.
And imagine imagine an HR department that you're not loathing at the point of going to talk to. You're like, oh, I don't have to go talk to HR. You actually get to look forward to working with them.
Exactly.
It will be positive.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So we have a question.
Absolutely. Often when I hear people talk about Agile, I wonder if we as Agile coaches don't make it seem more complicated than it really is. And when I think about what Agile does for an organization, regardless of what the industry actually is, it's about bringing healthy behaviors in to get to a much more healthy organization. So what would you say, you know, for a leader who says, well, I want to do Agile so that I can deliver more product, how would you bring in that aspect so that they understand that you're going to bring those behaviors to the organization as well?
Yeah, I think the idea of agility is making a company holistically more adaptive, more productive, more value-fulfilling, an accurate picture. I think you've seen a lot of movement lately. We were just chatting a bit before about Josh Karievsky, right? He did the keynote actually here in Atlanta at Agile 2016 around his modern Agile framework. So those five facets that I noted, I'm not the only one who's thinking this way and trying to simplify things. You'll see many threads of this effect. And he boiled it down to just four principles, right? So a lot of this, I think, is around saying, what are we really trying to achieve? Well, you know, more value, people who feel happier and safer at work, right? Who feel like they can take risks and experiment without the worry about getting, you know, canned as they go along. We need to make sure that we learn more from our users, interact with them more. So I think just casting that broader net and saying, this is about making our company more successful in the long run. Part of that's delivery, but it's not all delivery, right?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. A term that I've heard you use, in part by talking to you, but also, you know, stalking some of the material you've written, is business agility.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. What does that mean, and how do you help companies apply it?
Absolutely. So I think the heart of business agility really is the idea of trying to cross the silos effectively, right? That is having the entire company understand what this is and operate with these principles in mind. We can do short cycles. People should, you know, work more concurrently than in serial in general. We should have faster feedback loops, those sorts of ideas. And I think, you know, in many companies, it's just taking the idea outside of just the IT or the technology groups and saying, these ideas really apply everywhere. If you look at a holistically agile business, I think looking back at the works of, say, Mary and Tom Papendieck, they're well known for lean software development, a number of works to that effect, and they often discuss the idea of trying to essentially have an end-to-end view of what it takes to deliver one small thing in a company. Like if you had a crazy idea right now in your company, and let's say it was a crazy idea that took, you know, a matter of months, perhaps, to deliver a significant effort, that is, not something super minor, how long would it take, right? Where would there be time where it's just hitched up in the organizational bureaucracy in the machinery of your SDLC, let's say, versus people actively working on it and creating value in it? And I think if you kind of look at that value stream, then you can begin to see where a lot of the gaps are. If you have a value stream where the idea very quickly goes from that their term is concept to cash, right? And you have kind of an end-to-end, it hits one group, hits the next group, just flows right on through the process and gets out there, then that's kind of a good sign. And to that end, a lot of the recent work you've seen in business agility is actually reorganizing companies, redesigning them. Several of the efforts we're underway on right now with, in one case, one of the largest insurance companies in the world, is to actually reorganize to this value stream orientation, which means essentially getting rid of a lot of the existing traditional silos altogether, aligning under the core products and services of the organization, you know, views as their primary products and services, and then having basically, you know, explicitly designing the organization in such a way that that flow is smooth from one discipline to the next, end to end, including things like, say, finance, which traditionally just marching to the beat of a totally different drum. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay.
Where have you seen the connection between user experience and just what you described, solving problems for people in the organization and delighting end customers? You mentioned that path through marketing. Where have you seen that sort of thing connect?
Yeah, so with user experience, when I got into this in the early days, there was definitely a lot of conflict between traditional UX practitioners and, you know, and agile folks, because UX people are often of the mindset that we really have to figure everything out up front, right? That is, get a really comprehensive view of the user experience before we can design an appropriate response to it. And I think what Agile really does is amplify that ability, actually. And this is, it just comes back to the notion that you do, of course, need some sense of an end-to-end view of what the user experience is. But what you don't need, in a similar manner to, you know, building any sort of Agile or building anything using an Agile method, you don't need all the details up front. So rather than, I worked again with for instance, I'm not going to mention the company, but a very large sporty good manufacturer you've all heard of. They traditionally, UX was a bit of an issue here, because you'd have a separate UX group, and they would go and they would build, say, 500 annotated wireframes, and they would hand that to an agile development team, with air quotes here. And the problem is, of course, at that point, the team is utterly hindered in what they can realistically change without disrupting the entirety of the experience. So there, of course, you would much prefer, maybe we have a general storyboard at a high level of what we expect to happen, but, you know, the UX folks are there in the Agile team along with everybody else rather than external entity. So they can roll with the punches just like everybody else can. They can take and elaborate only the interaction contexts that are about to be built sometime soon. And the rest of it, they can test and learn as they go along. See, we have the beauty here of not being constrained by one cycle that ends. You don't have just 3 months to go do the whole UX thing before the rubber hits the road and the developers pick it up. Now you're running alongside them, you know, and you have the idea of things like value teams, right, which often would consist of, say, you know, led by someone like a product owner, and would consist of people like UX folks, business analysts, domain experts, you know, actual users, business stakeholders, and so on. Gives that team a capability to learn all along the way, right? So it takes it away from being a once and done thing and makes it more of a continuous effort.
I really like what you said about how moving to more of an agile process amplifies the work of UX. I know that with organizations I've worked with where we've had cross-functional teams that had your front-end and back-end devs and then your designer and then incorporating a UX team member, designers in that UX team can sometimes have a lot of conflict around how they think the best way is to lay something out or a certain interaction. And by being able to get those two groups to work together, they see how much more powerful it is to have both of those minds at the table. And I think that UX has really been done a great service by the improvements we've made with some of our tools that we now have to be able to track user responses and get quick feedback.
Yeah.
Because they're able to do these quick tests using tools like usertesting.com and some of these things where you can really quickly put an interface out there and get immediate feedback. And so it's allowed them to be more iterative than I think they felt they were able to be or perceived they were able to be previously.
It also allows them, I would call out things like A-B testing infrastructure, mm-hmm. right, is a key thing here, because it allows you the possibility of having several good ideas and, in fact, not having to decide what the one best idea is, which mm-hmm. is certainly a source of conflict in many teams of, you know, one senior person argue with another senior person, my way's better, no, my way is. And, you know, there may be no right answer here, honestly. Both are based on some certain assumptions. This allows us to go and say, what are the assumptions, right? Why do you think yours is better? What are the results we hope for? Put them both out there, right? It's often not that much more difficult to do a couple of different versions of something than it is to do one. And, you know, have the engine take care of it. Go and say, if they click this button more often, then that version wins, right? And it'll amplify it over time and naturally make that one the winning version. And you can get away from a lot of these arguments, right? Teams mm-hmm. can say, it's nice for us to try several different approaches sometimes. That's a big benefit. It's much better than it's just arguing about it in a
right.
theoretical capacity all
and
the time.
You can't argue with data.
Precisely.
So, yeah, one of my favorite things is when you get a user experience team member and a marketing data analyst in the room together, and when they're working well together, to get to see them pair on looking at the data and looking at the interactions on the site. And I just feel like, as we know, getting different people who think differently about the same problem, you get such extraordinary results.
I'll call out something else about that, too. The one other company I worked with in a Canadian real estate company, a small company, and they would essentially buy properties, renovate them, and then the company would be peopled by investors, which would invest in the new thing and benefit from it. Well, initially, even though this is a very small company, had a very heavy kind of process and bureaucracy. Each person had their own little set of spreadsheets, and they had 100-plus page requirements documents they had to bring in on like a weekly basis. And they would have hours and hours of meetings to take and compare all this stuff. Essentially, what they did was they took it and said, well, let's get all these people talking together in one meeting and then kind of record what they all decided, rather than having them essentially do tons of homework before the meeting and come with, you know, the flawless perfect answer where they just, you know, essentially integrated in the meeting. What this lets you do is get rid of a lot of tools, mm-hmm. get rid of a lot of meetings, right, and save a heck of a lot of time. They moved to basically one story map and one shared calendar, and that was it, right? It replaced literally about a dozen different artifacts, which mm-hmm. took hours and hours and hours out of the time. And they ended up boiling it down to about a three-hour meeting a week, or 3 hours worth of meetings, several different meetings, but about 3 hours collectively, whereas previously it was about between 12 and 15 hours, depending on what you were talking about. And they did all that in a day, right? One day transformation to get to that. Wow. So, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's fast. We have a question?
One question. So how do you, when you're engaging a major transformation, and that industry that company is in actually has traditional values that are more individualistic, and now you're trying to come up with a team-oriented, you know, collaboration value-driven. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything like that when you're getting into outside of IT?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, this has HR implications and how you actually manage people. If you're going to say, we're a meritocracy and it's all up to you, then that's the way people are going to behave, of course. But I think these don't necessarily have to be an utter conflict, right? I mean, I think it's fair to say that in Agile teams, we are looking for individuals to step up to the plate and be the best they can be. But the idea is they're not meant to do that all off on their own. And they're meant to do that in a way that supports the rest of the team. So I think that these don't necessarily have to be at odds if we can say that, you know, I mean, taking my own background, a lot of the things I've learned and a lot of things I teach today, I learned from other Agile team members and not by any sort of special training or anything of that nature, simply by working alongside them over time, I picked up new skill sets, which means I'm now more capable holistically, right? I feel like I can at least sit down and have an intelligent conversation about how to, you know, develop things and whatever language you choose to pick. And, you know, I wouldn't be the expert there, but it makes everything smoother. It makes the interaction smoother with my colleagues and, you know, it helps me to grow, opens up my career paths and so on. So I think there's a lot of that individual benefit that you can get from the rest of the team.
I think when you're changing values, right, where you identify where we're going to have, or at least to complement existing values that might be, you know, something you need to mitigate against, like, you know, investment banking has a heavy shark hunter type of mentality. Same thing with sales divisions. Heavy hunting type of, and so individualistic, and you're trying to get my sales over your sales. This is where HR needs to be consulted. They need, just like you said, you know, they need to be engaged to create this new drivers, things that will create this tipping point in this way of, you know, doing business.
Exactly so. Yeah, and often they're doing that by judging things against some higher level outcomes, right? It's not about what you've done. It's about what you've done in service to the team or the results the team has had in service of the business or some combination thereof.
you have a question?
Yep.
Just a question about that. When you said that it need to be from the team, we all understand on this one, but from the specifically from the HR to get onto the agility, what do you prefer as a really a starting point to implement? Because we always said that yeah, everyone has to be on agility, but where you think when there is nothing and we are trying, and specifically HR mode, mm-hmm. where you think is a more starting point for agility to come from?
I think I usually like to introduce a lot of the basic notions of Scrum and have them pick some little project to actually simulate the idea. A lot of HR work is going to look different when you dive into the different sorts of projects they might be doing, like redesigning a performance management system might be different from, you know, talking about how they do a lot of the internal discussions about benefits, for instance. So I would pick something and actually have them try a project with that internally, because a lot of this is about the in the book in particular, I take basically these two different perspectives. There's you doing it yourself as an HR team and department, right? Which, and of course, in part is meant to improve your productivity and give you all the usual benefits of agility. But really more what I'm going for there is, now you know what Agile is. So you can support it for the rest of the company, which is really what I see as the bigger picture in HR is they're there. Sure, doing it themselves is good. They're eating their own dog food, so to speak. But now they understand it, and they'll probably better understand how to, you know, keep the rest of the company and keep the policies in place from being onerous and limiting the growth of the company in this way.
A big linchpin for me in an organization is the finance side. It's the yearly planning.
Indeed.
Committing to things, and marketing, sales, they all have things that they commit to, product development. What's the appropriate batch size that you see people moving toward, or how are you moving them towards a smaller batch size? And yeah, love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think, and by the way, I agree, finance is a bit the linchpin. And in my experience, if I'm being honest, one of the hardest areas to change and one of the last ones, sadly. But I think it's moving towards more, at least quarterly planning, right? I actually see that pretty commonly these days, quarterly budgeting, rolling wave planning, rolling budgets. It's not a new idea, right? It's been around for a while, so pretty well, if you will, supported by the literature. I think in some organizations, they're making it even more dynamic than that. And I've seen a handful moving towards more like monthly cycles where it's very similar, right? You still have some notion of what you're spending, but month over month, you're essentially updating the budget, updating your plans, keeping things open-ended, applying that in that manner. One of the companies I've been working with locally in the DC area for some time is Fannie Mae, the secondary mortgage provider, basically. And they have actually begun experimenting in that area. They've made very rapid strides in just a few years, largely from having a lot of leadership support. And so they're actually investigating things like continuous budgeting, right? Looking into, and they deal with very large batches of money. So this is not a small thing at all. But I find that incredibly heartening, in fact, because that's a, you know, you're talking about a sort of a quasi-governmental organization here that would not be the first you'd expect to change necessarily, and yet they're largely leading the way. So I'm starting to feel a little bit better about the finance thing lately. But it's all about saying finance doesn't need to know where the money goes, right? I mean, in general, that is, they don't need to know exactly which IT project you're doing, all the benefits it needs to purvey, convey, and so on. They need to know, how much money do we need, you know, in general, to go and do the stuff we've got to do? And are we spending that money in the most intelligent way? And very rarely are finance of people to tell you, you know, that this is the best way to spend the money. That's going to be other areas of the business. So it's a matter of making sure that there's discipline in the spending, but that it's flexible.
So we've got just a few more minutes left. We've been talking a lot about the work you've been doing and what you've seen in the past, and I'm curious what you think comes next. What do you see as the future of these non-IT businesses working in more of an agile framework?
I think it's going to continue growing. I keep getting inquiries from various areas, but probably one of the most interesting areas I've seen lately is education, in fact. I've seen this now at several different levels, at the from actually running elementary school classrooms using this. There's an organization called EduScrum, which is kind of a sort of an open source framework, if you will, for using Scrum to run classrooms. I actually also saw at a level at the post-vocational level, I worked with the Rotterdam Hoge School. They're a essentially postgraduate, largely adult learning type of thing. and they deal with digital media programs. There they were actually implementing it as a way for the professors to keep up with the times, right? Because if you look at colleges, they're quite often seen as a bit archaic, technologically speaking. They're not, you know, teaching you the latest and greatest stuff. And they'd like to. So there, for instance, they're saying the professors don't actually load up the whole curriculum and plot it all out and have the whole, you know, everything plot out from the beginning. They have a certain percentage. When I was discussing, they were talking about 70% or so of the curriculum is pretty well settled and going to be consistently useful for the next year or two for sure. But then they keep the other bit open and they say, hey, students, what do you want to learn, right? And now they have actually some space in their backlog, do some multi-voting, you know, and they align things across the classrooms, do scrum of scrums alignment between the professors who have related disciplines. So I've seen a lot of movement there. And that's particularly interesting. So I think it's just going to continue to grow into other areas that you wouldn't necessarily expect it. You know, you got personal Kanban for running your household. That's been a fairly sizable thing for a number of years now. Mm-hmm. So it's not a new idea, but it just keeps expanding. And that's very exciting for me as a consultant.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because now we get to do lots of things in areas that you wouldn't naturally expect. And that means it's really got no end in sight.
That's awesome. Any final questions as we start to wrap up?
So Chris Merman recently wrote about the fact that executives think that we're doing Agile wrong. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that, but if you just think about that, executives think we're doing it wrong. Can you speculate on why they think we're doing it wrong and what we could do to maybe change their mindset?
By the way, there's a podcast on that. Plug, yes.
Yeah? Well, what did they think they were doing wrong? Did they, that's it? They said they thought we were doing it wrong?
They just said we were doing it wrong, and I can't remember the details, but just basically that they think of Agile more of a process than a change. Mm-hmm. That's really what it was. They think of Agile as a feature factory that's going to give them...
Feature factory, exactly.
Yes.
I think a lot of, you've seen the rise of a lot of frameworks, you know, and... take the scaled Agile framework, and my organization is a goal partner with those guys. We do a lot of safe training and consulting. You know, the problem though you encounter with any framework like that, where they're trying to give you a lot of insight into a lot of different tools and ways to do things, is that people look at it as a blueprint, right? They look at it as, we just got to implement this thing and it solves all our problems. And of course, that goes against the very heart of what Agile is. The word means adapt. Right. I mean, so if we're really saying here that we want to be agile, you have to view this as at a minimum something that is ever growing and evolving. Right. And so I think having people lock themselves to a framework and not at least see that framework as flexible and, you know, to be manipulated for their own purposes, I think it limits the ability for them to make this be the right thing for their organizations. It's definitely a mindset. I remember reading some years ago. A book called Lean Solutions, right? Which was actually, if anybody familiar with the word lean came from a book called Lean Thinking by James Womack, Dan Jones. This was a follow-up book where they were applying those same ideas to, in fact, non-manufacturing context, rather, right? Which is originally their books were about manufacturing. This was about, hey, what if they did lean stuff for your mechanic, right? I mean, what if at the grocery store they did more lean stuff? What would that look like? And, you know, it turns out there are a lot of examples of that already happening. I remember that they had a quote from some of the folks in Toyota who said they laugh when they hear about people doing lean because they always talk in terms of tools. Oh, lean is value stream mapping and running, you know, Kaizen events and this sort of thing. And the folks at Toyota are like, yeah, we did that years ago. Like, we moved on. We've got 1,000 new ways we do things now. It changes daily, right? So as soon as you begin to think of this as a settled question, you've already lost.
I also wonder how much of it has to do with the type of communication and visibility some of the executive leadership has into what's actually happening. Because a lot of times, the leaders at the very top aren't really in the day-to-day. They're not seeing it. They're just hearing about the output, not really the impact. And I think that can impact it. So wrapping up, we're about out of time. But if I know that we have plenty of people who would love to ask more questions, and I'm sure people listening to the podcast will as well, what's the best way for people to learn more or get in touch with you?
So you could reach me at arlen.bankston@lightspeed.com, and I'd be happy to answer questions from anyone. I'll just note that I'm actually here in the Atlanta area. We're doing this review. I'm here on about a monthly basis, also running Certified Scrum Master and Certified Product Owner classes. So, of course, people are welcome to join me there. you mentioned you heard the podcast, maybe we'll throw in a little discount right there too. But yeah, indeed, I would be willing to answer any questions from anyone.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. This was incredibly insightful, and excited to see what you do next.
Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Paul Elia, and I'm the guest producer for today's Agile Uprising podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes under Agile Uprising. Follow us on Twitter at Agile Uprising, and join our coalition at agileuprising.com. Before I close, I want to thank our hosts, the Agile Coaching Exchange Atlanta Chapter and JDC Group, who allowed us to be their first guest to use the newly expanded Atlanta facility meeting space. Sean Bookoff is the ACE Atlanta chapter leader. Sean, tell our listeners about our group.
Sure, thanks, Paul. Agile Coaching Exchange Atlanta chapter is an offshoot of ACE SoCal, Southern California, which is also part of or an offshoot of ACE London. And we are promoting and building an Agile coaching community. If you're an Agile coach or you're interested in on the path of Agile coaching, please join us. You can find out more information about the Agile Coaching Exchange and all our chapters at agilecoachingexchange.com.
Thanks, Sean. And Katie Mogul is here with JDC Group. Katie, would you let our listeners know what you guys do and how they can find out more about you?
Sure, Paul. Well, it's a pleasure to have the Agile Coaching Exchange Group here in our new home. I am a technical recruiter for the JDC Group. A little bit about our background. We are a 12-year-old staff augmentation company that was founded by Johannes Dorsch over roughly 12 years ago. We specialize in functional and technical opportunities where we staff individuals anywhere from program management to application development all the way to SAP consulting. And you can find us on the web at jdcgroup.com, as well as we are on LinkedIn and all forms of social media.
Another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.